Well, it's wonderful to be back here in Albuquerque, and I just want to say also, before I begin, to all of you who put effort into making the Sangha happen and making it possible for me to come out here, I really appreciate that, so thank you. And also to Andrea and Todd for putting me up again. It's just a wonderful place to stay, so thank you. So tonight I'm going to be talking about, once again, right speech. So once again, I'm going to be talking about talking. And last week, for those of you who were not here, and just a reminder, what I spoke about was kind of the skillful use of silence and how we unskillfully use it, and gaining skill in using silence. And silence is a way of communicating. It's a way of talking or speech. So tonight, I want to now venture into that even trickier area, that arena of speech, of speaking. And as I spoke about last week, I think we're all on the same page, right? How difficult and challenging it is, that this realm of communication. So how do we skillfully engage in communication? So tonight, what I want to share with you is just some reflections about the skillful use of speech and also some unskillful ways that we use it as well. Before getting into kind of speech itself, I want to say a few things about this idea of skillful and unskillful, and I think this is very important in terms of speech, in terms of the whole path, really. I think it's important, and it can be misleading, because we do use this word right speech. And when we hear that there's right speech, there must be wrong speech. And I think that can be misleading, because then that can give us a sense that that there's some right answer out there about how to speak. That it's kind of like an equation. So 4 + 4 = 8, right? And that's the right answer. And if you put 7 or 6 or 9, you're wrong. Just so you know. And in that kind of equation, there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. And I want to point out that's not the case with speaking, with right speech. It's not like there's some magic number where we're going to say, oh, this is right and this way was wrong. Because that's a big setup if we do that. If we're getting lost in right and wrong, because then we're not seeing the nuance of skill within speech. Have you noticed your mind do that, though, around speaking? Oh, I did it wrong. I did it all wrong. It was actually the wrong number. Actually, that's usually the way we judge it, is we see the wrongness of it and not so much the rightness of it or any skill in it. And then we're really missing, I think, what the Buddha is trying to point us towards in terms of this skillful speech. I think it's more like the analogy that I came up with, or that I was thinking about, is I remember when I played clarinet in a jazz band in college. It was a blast. So it was jazz, so part of it was improvisation. And so what I needed, and that was a skill. That was a skill that I needed to learn how to do. And so the things that I needed to learn that skill was I needed some guidelines, right? So I practiced my scales. I learned some music theory, for example, the chord structure of jazz. And I learned these things. And then I also practiced. Like a lot of times I had this, even though I was playing clarinet, I had a Charlie Parker omnibook, which was great because it had many of Charlie Parker's improvs in it. And so then I would learn his riffs on the clarinet. And it wasn't so much because Charlie Parker's way was right, but it gave me the skill to engage in improvisation. And then when I was up there on the stage and we were playing, I'd have nights where there was more skill and less skill. But it wasn't a matter of being right and wrong. At times my heart was really into it and I was there. It was flowing. And other times it wasn't as much. So this is more what we mean by skillful speech, is this gradation of gaining this skill in this process. So it's a skill. It's not about being perfect. We can really mislead ourselves if we're looking for perfection. Because if it's looking for perfection, then it's in this realm of right and wrong. And usually, if you've noticed, like I've noticed, have you ever gone for perfection in your life? Where has it led? Where does it lead? Yeah, not a good place. So this practice is not about perfection. On the ethical level, it's about skill, which is different than perfection. Do you hear the difference in this? In some ways, it's coming to terms with non-perfection. Like there was the third patriarch, who was kind of the third great Zen master, you could say. He was attributed to writing the first Zen poem. And an interesting practitioner, because he didn't start to practice till later on in life, till into his 40s. And he began to practice when he was quite ill. And then he became this practitioner with great depth. And he wrote this this poem in Japanese. It's the Shinjin Mei, which is usually translated as, I think, the verses on the faith mind. And he has this wonderful quote in it, or this wonderful saying in it, that really speaks to what I'm alluding to. He says, to live in this realization, basically to live or to embody awakening, is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. Can you get a sense of that? Wouldn't that be nice? To not have anxiety about non-perfection. That's the direction we're going in. And one thing that can help support this is if we engage in ethical conduct, if we engage in something like right speech as a skill rather than something that we're trying to perfect. Actually, Peter Hirschhoff, who is he's a Zen scholar, speaks about this in this Pali word kusala. Kusala means wholesome, in terms of how the Buddha talks about that which is wholesome and unwholesome, and really pointing out that kusala, which means wholesome, is not, again, it's not some kind of generic or absolute good, but rather it's this refining a skill that is situationally appropriate. So again, not about perfect and imperfect or good or right or wrong, but skill. So skillful speech. Last week I invited you to consider skillful silence, reflecting upon these five marks that the Buddha talks about in terms of right speech. So I want to just go over those again, because I want to use these guidelines as we reflect on right speech. And just I read this last week as well, so you might remember this. So the Buddha said, if speech has five marks, practitioners, it is well spoken, not badly spoken, blameless, and above reproach by the wise. What are these five marks? It is speech that is timely, true, gentle, purposeful, and spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So those are some guidelines that we can follow. Guidelines to bring skill into our speaking. And as I mentioned last week, I like to break it down to four because I like smaller lists. So is it true? Is it kind? Is it timely? Is it useful? And so I'll use this as a kind of a guideline. And maybe we'll get through it, or maybe we won't. I'm not sure. And some of these I'll speak more about, and some I'm just going to brush over a bit. So the first one is speaking what is true. One way to get a sense of this spiritual path is that we're beginning to live our lives in accordance with the way things are. So we're beginning to live in a way that's in accordance with the truth. And if it's in accordance with the truth, then our speech should reflect that. Can we speak honestly and truthfully? You know, it said throughout the Buddha's lives, you know, once the Buddha had made, you know, many lifetimes ago, this intention to become a Buddha, throughout all those lives, it said that he never told a lie, because he felt that that was so central to a spiritual path. Especially since we're trying to get in line with what is true, with the way things are. The Zen master Dogen speaks about this precept of not lying. And it's interesting the phrase he uses around this. And I was always struck by this. He says, and at first I was thinking, why would he put this in here? But this is what he puts in when he's talking about this precept. He says, the whole universe is moistened with nectar, and the truth is ready to harvest. I find it striking, this idea that truth is something that's harvested. That really speaking the truth is this process of harvesting that which is true. So it's harvesting that which is living and nourishing. So when we speak the truth, it should have this quality of nourishment, that it's nourishing to ourselves and to others. It's something that's living. It's not some kind of static truth. I just find it a striking simile that he's using there. And of course, the best way to begin this activity of speaking the truth is to make sure that we're honest with ourselves. Have you noticed how it's a strange phenomenon, how we can lie to ourselves, or we're not quite so honest with ourselves? The biggest time I realize that is when I'm blaming somebody else. Then I know I'm probably not being so honest. So that's where it begins, is this real honesty with ourselves. Actually, I'm gonna go on to kindness rather than going into that anymore. Well, actually, one more thing about speaking truth is one of the guidelines. What's most important about what the Buddha is saying, that speech must be true, is that what makes that skillful speech is that it's combined with it being kind, timely, and useful. So the Buddha is very clear. Just speaking the truth, there's nothing skillful about that. It needs to be combined with these other marks, or it's not going to be skillful. And I'm sure all of us here can think of a time where we really felt like we were saying what was really going on. And then you might notice, wow, that wasn't really so skillful. That was actually quite harmful. So that's the most important thing to remember about speaking the truth, is these other qualities, because it helps balance it out. So the next one is kindness, speaking with a mind filled with kindness. So I want to examine this quality of kind speech in terms of, you know, those times where we have to speak about something that's very challenging to speak about. Or we need to speak out about something. About those difficult times where it just feels like no matter what we're going to say, it's not going to go right. That's what I want to concentrate on in terms of this quality of right speech. So I'm going to speak less about, but it's equally important for us to engage in kind speech when it's easy to do that also. And this is also something that's overlooked. It's so important that to really seize upon any opportunity that we have to speak out from gratitude or sympathetic joy, when we see the joy in somebody else's life of really joining them with that through our speech, or being generous with our words, or compassionate. So it's also important in the easy times, not only in the difficult times. So I want to share with you what the Buddha says about engaging in skillful speech with this in mind. He's very clear about not engaging in speech that is divisive or divides. And he says, What a practitioner has heard here, that practitioner does not repeat over there, so as to cause dissension there. And what a practitioner has heard there, that practitioner does not repeat here, so as to cause dissension here. Thus, practitioners unite those that are divided, and those that are united, he or she encourages. Concord gladdens practitioners. Practitioners delight and rejoice in concord, and it is concord that he or she spreads with their words. So this is kind of tricky, especially when we're talking about speaking out against something or having that difficult conversation. So how do we engage in a conversation that's not divisive? How do we do that? What do we keep in mind? And I want to be really clear that there's a difference between divisive speech and simply trying to avoid conflict. There's a difference between divisive speech or speech that divides and somebody becoming uncomfortable with what we're sharing. There's a difference there. And we mix them up. Sometimes we can think that divisive speech is anything that's going to make somebody feel uncomfortable. That's not what the Buddha's talking about here. I think one thing to remember in terms of kind speech is that sometimes for a greater harmony to arise, some kind of upheaval is going to have to happen first. It's just inevitable. There are some things that are going to have to be shaken up before there's a greater harmony or a true sense of concord or uniting. Now, just as I gave that example last week of when I was at the Zen Center, at the Zen Monastery, and some of us decided to speak up about this sexual misconduct that was going on. It was the path to a greater or a deeper sense of harmony. That conversation needed to happen. It was necessary. The kind of harmony that was there in the center, in the monastic community, was filled with harm and discord. So there has to be that willingness. One way of seeing it is that you might have noticed, you know, especially for those of you who have done a longer retreat, how a part of this practice is really going through those phases where things are really kind of chaotic and unsettled. Have you ever noticed that? You go to a retreat and you're thinking, oh, this is going to be so peaceful and wonderful. And then you sit down with your mind. And then you notice something else. But we need to go through that for a deeper sense of settling or a deeper sense of harmony to arise. That's inevitable. It's the same with speech, or it's the same sometimes with communities. We have to be willing to go through that. But how do we go through that again? How do we go through that skillfully? This is a tricky area. This is what I find one of the most challenging things about this practice is embodying the practice in those times of needing to communicate something that's difficult to communicate. So I want to be clear about what this kindness is. This is not, it's not about airing another person's imperfections for the public to see or creating drama. It's not about getting back at somebody. It's rather speaking with this intention of greater harmony. It's also, I want to be really clear, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, it's this kindness of, how to put this, I'm right, you're wrong kind of kindness, and I'm going to show you how you're wrong. Because I'm really being kind, because I can see you're misguided, and you really don't see things so clearly. So here is my kindness. You ever expressed that kind of kindness before? I'm right, you're wrong kindness is not loving kindness. I find one of the most helpful things to remember when I'm engaging in difficult speech or these conversations that are so difficult is making sure that I'm not getting lost in this dynamic of us and them. Because to me, that's what it really boils down to, is when my mind has divided the situation into us and them, then division is already there and I'm going to be speaking divisively. Right? There's already the intention to divide. So I want to speak a little bit about this dynamic of us and them. So not only do we have these minds that create these identities about who I am, but we also have these minds that identify with one group and not another group. And I want to point out, this isn't inherently bad. Just in the same way that we can use the language of having an identity and it can be really useful. The language of identity can be useful. And the way our mind groups things can be useful. But if we're not aware of how it's happening and how it functions, then we can get lost in it and then it can lead to harm. You know, the ability to identify with a group has some positive qualities. It allows us to connect. It allows us to create community. Here we've created a group. And this is a group that's different than other groups. And it's probably one of the reasons why all of us come here is because it has qualities in it that we don't find in other groups. And so identifying or coming together with this group can be very supportive. It can give a sense of safety and a sense of direction. It's also very important in terms of grouping together in terms of oppression. Many times groups come together as a result of oppression. And that forming of a group can be so important. But it can also create divisions, right? It can cast others out of the group so that there's outsiders. So it can limit who we really connect to. And then it can divide. You know, and I'm sure have you noticed that in your mind, how your mind does that? Sometimes with the smallest things. It's amazing the things that we bring into our minds and then all of a sudden it creates a division. And then if we believe in that division, then the direction we go to is probably going to lead to harming. Now, I was just noticing how little it can take sometimes for this mind to do that. For example, driving behind another car and seeing it, I can just see three letters. The letter N, R, A. Right? That's all it is, three letters. I see three letters and already my mind is going to dividing me from the person in that car. And I haven't even met that person. I have not even met that person. I have no idea what they look like, how they would speak to me. And all of a sudden there's a division between me, my views, and their views. You ever notice your mind do that? Yeah, phew, not the only one. So we do it around politics. We do it around social things. Yeah. And then I want to point out that then what's inevitably going to, if I have a conversation with that person, what's inevitably going to be there is already divisive speech if I'm acting out of that quality of us and them. And I want to point out that it's important to remember that the way we group people is simply and merely a construct. There is not anything inherently right about it. So there's a man by the name of David Barraby who writes this whole book about this dynamic of creating us and them. And really pointing out that how we group is, it can be useful, but it's important to remember that it's not inherently right. So I can group people in many different ways, but they're all just as valid as the other way. So I can group people in terms of nationality or race or sexual orientation. But I can just as easily group people in terms of if they're left-handed or right-handed. Or if someone's broken their leg or not broken their leg. The grouping can be useful, but we have to remember that it's just a construct. And then we can actually utilize it rather than fall victim to it. Just to take a moment of, can you imagine what it would be like to really communicate with every person that you meet without this dynamic of us and them? Can you get a sense of that? Of the kind of communication that can flow if we don't get lost in that? Even the difficult stuff. That would be such a radically different conversation. So how do we embody this? How do we embody going beyond us and them? So I want to talk just about two things in this realm. I think one thing that can be so important is making sure that we put our attention, a lot of our attention, on how we're relating to the other person or the group of people that we're talking to, rather than whatever the issue is. Because if we're only thinking about the issue or the topic, then we can feel like, again, I'm really right about this topic. And then I forget about who I'm talking to and how I'm relating to them. You know, it's very similar to in meditation. We want to become sensitive to, aware to, what is our relationship to what's going on right now? What's my relationship to the anger that's arising? Not what the anger is about, but what's my relationship to it? Because that's the key to being sensitive to if that's going to lead to healing, awakening, liberation, or to harm. So that's one thing that I find very useful is becoming curious about that. How am I relating to this person? Because then we're going to notice if this quality of us and them is there or not. But it's tricky because our minds will get lost in the issue of I'm right, I'm wrong. And that's the next thing I want to share with you is also what's underneath this, of course, is this one of these qualities of clinging that the Buddha talks about, which is this attachment to views and opinions. So there was four kinds of clinging that the Buddha mentioned. One was to sense desire, another one was to rites and rituals, to views and opinions, and the other one was believing in a sense of self. So one of them is this attachment to views and opinions. So I want to just say a few things about this. And I actually want to share with you a passage from the Zen Master Dogen about this. And it's a little tricky, but I find it's revealing of where the practice, where the direction of this practice. So he says in one of his writings, the Ginjo Koan, and I'll explain this because this first paragraph is a little tricky. It says, when the Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, so when we're not fully liberated, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. Because it is important, because we would think it'd be the opposite. So we would think that when the Dharma doesn't fill our whole body and mind, we would think that something is missing. And that when Dharma fills our entire body and mind, we'd think it's sufficient. But he changes it around. So what is he talking about here? So he's saying that when we really start to wake up, we begin to see that something's missing. So what is this something missing that he's talking about? So he gives an example. So he says, for example, when you sail out in a boat to the middle of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. Maybe some of you have been on the ocean have noticed that. It looks circular. But the ocean is neither square nor round. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. Though there are many features in the dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. In order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet, or in a drop of water. Do you hear what he's pointing to here? This quality of what's missing. He's saying that when you begin to practice, what you begin to notice is that any view that you have of this world is incomplete. That is the quality of having a view. You're going to be out on the ocean and it looks round, but to others it's going to look square, or at another moment it might look square. When our understanding deepens, that's what we begin to see. So it's not like we come to some view that contains the world. And this is important because sometimes we can engage in the practice thinking, oh, one day I'm going to really understand it. I'm going to get it. And then I'm going to have the right answer. It's not about that. It's not about getting the right answer or the right view. Even the Eightfold Path, right view is something that's a vehicle towards awakening. It's more about resting and noticing that views are incomplete. Such a different place to rest, because we're always resting in our view of the world. But what's it to rest in noticing that there is a view of the world coming up and that it's incomplete? That's a radically different place to rest. And then what is it like to engage in a conversation with engaging in our views, even though they're incomplete, and hearing another person's views with that kind of noticing going on? Is this making sense? And how radically different that would be to have that relationship to our views? That they're not really the right view? So, in some ways, waking up is seeing that things are incomplete. In particular, my view is always incomplete. What a relief, huh? Phew. Oh, God. I have to get in all those arguments and prove I'm right. And man, my life feels already better. Nice. Okay, so maybe just a few more things about just a few things about timely and useful. And there's one thing that I want to share with you that the Buddha said in terms of speech being timely, which is interesting. It says, in the case of words that the Tathagata knows to be factual, so the Tathagata is the Buddha. So in the case of the words that the Buddha knows to be factual, true, beneficial, but unendearing and disagreeable to others, he has a sense of the proper time for saying them. Isn't that nice? So when something is factual, true, and beneficial, but we know it's going to be disagreeable, then we find the right time to say it. So there are times, obviously he's saying, there's times that we're going to be saying things that are unendearing and disagreeable. That's not the problem. It can still be kind and true and timely and useful. But that's when we have to be really sensitive to the timely quality of our speaking. Just one thing that can be helpful in remembering and finding the right time is getting a sense for when I'm ready to say something and when another person is possibly in the realm to actually hear it. Next, I want to share with you a little bit about our physiology. Because our physiology, the state of our physiology, has a lot to do with if we can hear something or not. And you might have noticed this. For example, when we're what I'd call activated, when our system is in this kind of fight, flight, freeze mode, where I'm anxious, my hearing actually, it literally does not work in the same way. And my brain doesn't work in the same way. And you might have noticed that when somebody's trying to communicate with you when you're really upset, And you can't understand a word that they're saying. Ever have that experience? You're not in the space. Your physiology is not in the space to hear. And when your system is activated like that, it actually can't hear the nuance in the human voice, the prosody of the human voice. The ear is literally working differently. Yet when that activation comes down and there's more of this, this parasympathetic activity in the nervous system and what they call the ventral vagal aspect of the parasympathetic nervous system, the ear works differently. It can actually hear the prosody of the human voice, and it can, the way we see, the way our eyes work, it can pick up subtle facial expressions. So we need to be, our physiology needs to be in the right space to speak, to actually express, and to hear. And the more we get sensitive of when we're in that space, the more we can get sensitive when another person is in that space. So that we're actually speaking to somebody else when we know they can actually hear us. This is really important. You might just want to become curious about that. It's a really fascinating thing. Like another, one way that you might see this is, have you ever been in a restaurant that's not extremely loud, but it's kind of noisy around you? And you're sitting there and the person across from you is talking to you and you can't hear them really? Sometimes what's going on is that our systems are a little bit activated and they're a little bit nervous about being in this in such an environment. And if you really allow yourself to look around and to check out the environment, a lot of times there can be a settling can happen and it's wild. You can notice, oh, now I can hear that person's voice. What's happened? The ears are actually literally working differently because you've allowed yourself to settle down and feel safe, if it's safe. Does that make sense? So this, I think, can be a wonderful tool for getting a sense of when speech is timely. When's the right time? The other thing that comes under timely and useful is to avoid idle chatter. And I want to distinguish idle chatter from small talk. Idle chatter, the way to understand idle chatter is it's that chattering that we do that really doesn't have a clear intention behind it. It's kind of babbling. And you might notice those times. There's not really any clear intention behind your speaking. It's just kind of dribbling out. Idle chatter. Yet I do feel that there can be a very clear intention to engage in small talk. Small talk can be very useful. So it's important to see that sometimes the best kind of conversation to have is not much of a conversation. And sometimes it's the best way to connect. The ideal way to connect. I remember one time where this came in so handy. I was on one of those airport shuttles and I was going up to this small town in Colorado. Somebody had asked me to officiate a wedding. And I was just chatting with this woman next to me and I don't know how it came up in the conversation. I think we're talking about maybe environmental issues. And I mentioned this environmental organization that I love to support. And man, it was like I had just said the name of the devil. It was the conversation went from pretty good to pretty bad to really bad. It was amazing. I would have never even thought that this environmental organization would have such an emotional charge for somebody. So it was really getting very hot and tense. And then luckily, what I did, and luckily she joined me with this, is we just started small talk, like about the weather. It was great. It allowed us the opportunity to find something, even if it was superficial, to connect with. Because that wasn't going to be something that we're going to connect with, and we sure weren't going to be seeing each other's views on that. This wasn't going to be happening. But I found it to be really remarkable to have somebody next to me that we had such radically different views to be willing to just have small talk with me as a way of connecting. That's speech that's true. It's very kind because it's about connection. It was very timely because it was getting bad. It was useful. So it's just being clear about when we're using small talk, why we're using it. What's the intention behind it? There, our intention was to connect. Connecting is a wholesome intention. Just one last thing. This is a... I think I should go into this, but I want to. Another aspect of speaking that I feel is important to remember is to be aware of language itself and the role of language in our lives. You know, I think in order to refine our speaking, we need to carefully examine what our relationship to language really is and some of the assumptions that we have around language. One of the assumptions that sometimes we have around language is that we feel like it accurately describes the world that we live in. And that just ain't true. I just want to point that out. And we can get fooled by it because if you consider the world that you usually live in, it's going to be a world of description. We live in a way that's always mediated by language. You might want to notice how much of your day goes by where it's really mediated by a thought, some kind of word structure. That's the world that we live in, a world of description, a world of language. Yet this practice is going somewhere else. It's allowing us to touch experience directly in an unmediated way and then allowing us to move in the world from that space. You know, language is important. It's important. It's what it is to be human and to communicate. And it continually deceives us. So we need to be aware of this deception. How does language deceive us? It makes things static. Right? So, for example, the easiest way of seeing that is when we use language, for example, we come across a friend, Peggy, Sue, John, Bill, and all of a sudden we're using a word to describe them, which can be useful in terms of communicating. But what has language done is that Bill or Sue today is the same Bill or Sue as tomorrow or yesterday. But that ain't the case. That's definitely not the case. So it confines our experience, and we can be deluded by that. We're continually deluded by that. We've identified the world, and it fixes it. And the world isn't like that. Right? It's impermanent. It's flowing. Another thing that language does is that it separates experience. We've been handed down this language our construction of experience now is that there's a subject, and then there's a subject usually doing something. So you have a subject with a verb, and then a lot of times an object. So these three different things. But that's not really the taste of that. Now, here I am speaking to you. When you really hear the activity of speaking and hearing, it might not be that at all. Actually, it isn't that at all. It has nothing to do with that. But we can get lost in that. So really to engage in skillful speech is seeing if we can really tap into, especially with meditation, our direct experience. That direct taste with experience and allowing speech to emerge from that. Then we're allowing something to emerge that can go beyond language. You can really connect and touch another person. Communicate something deeper. So may our skillful speech lead to the liberation of all beings. Thank you.